From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. Hey, I'm Dasmi Anishat.
And I'm Carson Fong.
Welcome to the newest member of our Terra Informa team. Doing great so far. This week, we'll be your hosts for this next half hour of environmental news. And you guys are witnessing history this week because we're starting our partnership with the show Science Faction. They're committed to telling unbelievable science stories with none of the jargon. Once a month, you'll get a tag team show, and this month, we hear about the secrets of fire ants.
But first, we have another buggy story, how insects can be co-detectives in solving crime. Piecing together a crime can be a messy business. Police can run up against unreliable witnesses or destroyed evidence. But what if the animals around the body could tell you a story about what happened? Chris Chang-Yen Phillips has this story from forensic entomologist and Simon Fraser University professor Gail Anderson in Vancouver.
And the victims involved two young women who had been shot in the head from a single shot from a 22, and they were found on May the 17th. By two young men that I always call two innocent young hikers. They were actually on their way to attend their marijuana patch when they found the young ladies, but fortunately they had the decency to report this to the police. And it was a case where I wasn't able to attend the scene. The police attended the crime scene, so they did a collection at the scene and then brought the insects to me. Hi, I'm Dr. Gail Anderson from the School of Criminology at Simon Fraser University, and I'm a board-certified forensic entomologist.
For privacy reasons, Gail couldn't tell us the names of the people involved in this story, so consider this her interpretation of what happened to these women.
Well, this is a case from quite a few years ago now. It was a time when the police were not yet used to the idea of calling a civilian into a crime scene. So the police collected the evidence and sent it to me.
What do you hope that you're able to find when you first arrive at a scene?
I hope I'm going to be able to find insects in a situation that I'm going to be able to help. I mean, it's frustrating when you get to a scene and there aren't any insects, or the insect evidence has been damaged. Or it's a situation where, for instance, you've got a body that's found in early spring in the prairie somewhere, and they could have been there all winter, and I can't tell because the insects aren't going to be there then. So I'm going to say, well, certainly she was dead by beginning of May of this year, but seeing as that was the start of the insect season, she could have died, in February, but I can't tell, and that's frustrating. And so the insects were collected and sent to me, and I did an analysis. But because the police were doing the collection, they collected from the body, but they didn't realize they had to collect also from outside the body, because once the insects reach a certain stage in their development, they leave the body looking for a nice, safe place in which to pupate. And so a lot of the older insects, the insects that put my time frame back the furthest, might have already left the body. But I don't know that for sure. They could have done, they might not have done. So what I had to do was come up with an underestimate of time since death. So I said the death had occurred on or before May the 6th. Had probably occurred before May the 6th, because as I say, I was underestimating it. And I always work with a minimum anyway, because that's the most safe thing to do in any of these situations. Well, I submitted my report, and sometime later the police brought forward two eyewitnesses who said they'd seen the killings take place in front of them on May the 3rd. Well, obviously, they can be a lot more specific than I can be because they were actually there. They saw it happen. But if you just stop and think about that for a second, they say they saw the murder take place in front of them, but they didn't bother to tell anybody. So are the police going to believe them? Primarily, insects will give an estimate of elapsed time since death, but there are a lot of other things we can do with insects. For instance, insects are attracted primarily to a wound site on a body. And if there isn't a wound site, they go for the natural orifices. Now, once the body's even slightly decomposed, it may be very difficult to see where those wounds are. And you can get a very fatal wound that doesn't actually hit the hard tissue. So, you can get a wound in the gut or in the throat or something like that, and it doesn't actually hit the hard tissue, so you can't see that on the skeleton. But if you look at the pattern of colonization of the insects, if the insects have colonized, say, in the gut first and then later colonized the orifices, then it would be a strong suggestion that that's a wound in that area. Now, I'm not going to be the one to make the call. That's going to be a forensic pathologist. But as an entomologist, I'm going to say, hey, we need to look really closely in this particular area because it's quite likely there's a wound in this site. And we can use them to work out whether the body's been moved from one place to another. Certain species of insects are very specifically found in one area and not another. For instance, some insects are very commonly found in an urban region, but you'd never find them in a rural region, and vice versa. So if you find bodies in a rural area and the insects on them come from an urban area, that would suggest that the body has been moved from a city area out into the bush area.
What insects were you able to find in that first set of...
Well, the very first insects that colonize a body after death are the Calophoridae, also known as blowflies. That's the blue or green metallic buzzy flies you see buzzing around all over. They're the ones attracted to your garbage. And they're interested in your food or your garbage, not for themselves, but they're looking for somewhere nice to lay their eggs. They're looking for a nursery for their babies. And so that's what the dead body is. It's a nursery for their babies. That's somewhere that they can lay their eggs. Those eggs will hatch into maggots. The maggots will feed on the body and then eventually move away, pupate, just like a caterpillar forms a cocoon, and then emerges the adult fly, and life keeps on going. So what we found there was maggots on the body of a certain age, but the insects, the oldest insects they found, were just starting to leave the body. Hadn't quite done it yet, but were just starting to. So it's quite possible some of them already had, and I might have missed those. Hence I said May 6th, but could have been earlier. So the police brought forward two eyewitnesses who said they'd seen the killings take place in front of them. So are the police going to believe them? Well, the police did believe them because they have what we call the holdback, or the key fact information. And key fact information is something about a crime scene that we release to nobody. It might be something about the victim's positions, what they were wearing, how they died, what the weapon was, anything like that. But it's something that's going to be known only to the killer, to any eyewitnesses to the crime, to the police that work the crime scenes, and people like me who are privy to this sort of information. It's not something that's ever released to the media. It's not even something that the family are told. So it's holdback information. And this means when somebody comes forward and says that they committed this crime, or somebody confesses in an interrogation, and they say something like, "I'm sorry, I shot her." Well, no, you didn't. We can move on to the next person because we know that she wasn't shot, or whatever. So this kind of information is involved in most of our homicides, and it's very, very useful to work out who's telling the truth. And in this particular case, the two boys did know the holdback information. So the police were quite sure that the boys had, in fact, been witnesses and had, in fact, been about to be the next victims, because the guy went bang, 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 and on the third shot, the bullet jammed, and the two young guys ran like hell. But the question is the jury going to believe them? Because, again, they saw a murder take place and they didn't come forward. And then it got worse because defense brought forward what was known in prosecution circles as the Elvis witnesses. You know, people that claim they see Elvis all the time. Well, these two nice, sweet, middle-aged ladies, everybody's mom, swore down dead that they'd seen one of the victims alive and well and shopping at the mall on May the 9th. Now, who are you going to believe? These two nice, sweet, middle-aged ladies with no obvious hidden agenda, or these two young guys who said they saw a murder take place and never bothered to tell anybody? So all of a sudden, my evidence became vital because I could say that death had occurred on or before May the 6th. Yes, they could have easily died on the 3rd when the young boy said they did, but there's no way she was alive and well and shopping at the mall on May the 9th. She was very dead by that point.
How did you feel when you knew your evidence would decide the fate of the man who'd been accused?
Well, that was quite a long time ago, so it's kind of scary, you know, when you realize that your evidence is the most important part there. But it makes you feel really good, too, because I'm not going to say anything in court that I'm not very sure of. I'm only going to say what I absolutely know, and science doesn't lie. So if that's the case, that's the case, and that's excellent. That means the right people are going to get convicted. It does make myself and all of my students, hopefully under me, very, very cautious about what we do, in that we, you know, you repeat things many times, and I impress upon my students that you don't say anything unless you're sure of it. You put all the caveats in place and that sort of thing. Because in a lot of science, you know, you publish something and then you do some more work and you think, well, that wasn't quite correct. Now I'm changing that in the next publication. You can't do that here because we might have used that in court in a certain situation. So you've got to be very, very sure and very, very careful of what you do. But it also means that you feel really good about your research because you know that it's doing something really valuable. It's being really well used.
That's interesting. I'd never thought about the timeline issue before. Like if someone puts out a study and it turns out that their research there was a flaw in it, usually the only impact that it has is on the people reading their research. But
yeah, or you just think, oh, so we will look at it in this direction. This is why I say it's very, very important to look at a minimum time of death rather than to try to give an average or mean, standard errors, and never a maximum, anything like that. I want to be able to say something I can say in court absolutely for sure. Because courts don't want to hear about, you know, 75% this and that sort of thing. They want some absolutes. But I'm always going to err on the side of caution. I'm going to underestimate that timing. I'm going to tell you how long the insects have been there, not the actual time of death. And we just presume that death occurred prior. Now, who are you going to believe? These two nice, sweet, middle-aged ladies with no obvious hidden agenda, or these two young guys who said they saw a murder take place and never bothered to tell anybody. My testimony was believed, and it supported that of the two young guys, refuted that of the middle-aged ladies. So when the ladies got up on the stand, they were not believed, and when the young boys got up on the stand, they were believed, and they could say he did it. And he was convicted of two counts of first-degree murder. He's presently serving life without parole for 25 years. That's the kind of thing that my evidence will do. People ask me, how much training do I have in forensics? Absolutely zero. All my training is in entomology and biology, zoology, and then I was asked by the police to apply that knowledge into a forensic setting. So my actual knowledge of its application was received at the crime scene from the autopsy, from the pathologist, from the lawyers I worked with, that sort of thing, all in the field.
So you started your professional career in entomology, and now you've
moved... Yes, exactly. As a medical, well, as a basic entomologist at first, I suppose, and then specifically as a medical and veterinary entomologist.
Yeah. So how has your research changed your relationships with insects, with nature around you?
Well, I'm a zoologist, so I've always been interested in animals of all types, and I find insects fascinating. Most of my work is with insects originally, you know, that sort of were harmful. So, you know, mosquitoes and biting flies and things like that that cause damage to humans. Now I'm dealing with insects that most people find fairly repulsive, but they are nature's little garbage recyclers. They're very, very important in our ecosystem. And more to the point now, when we start looking at them in a forensic context, they're incredibly valuable to us.
That was Gail Anderson from Simon Fraser University. Thanks to Chris Chang-Yen Phillips for that story.
Before we go, check out the medley of environmental goings-on around Canada.
On Sunday, January 18th, from 1 to 4 p.m., the Strathcona Wildlife Centre will be hosting BioBlitz, a fun and nature-filled afternoon.
Activities include a short talk on how biologists count moves from above, find clues from scat, and learning about the fascinating world of beavers,
heading out on the trail with a professional biologist to learn more about the study of wildlife through tracks, signs, and sounds,
short demonstrations on using wildlife cameras, radio telemetry, and the art of tracking,
and a scavenger hunt. At the end, there will be hot drinks and campfire snacks. You can walk, ski, or snowshoe, and equipment rentals are available.
The Sustainable Building Advisor Program is a course and is running from January 16th to May 2nd. It is a comprehensive certification program that trains you in ways to design, construct, and manage buildings that are resource efficient, environmentally responsible, cost-effective, and healthy for all occupants. It culminates with a final presentation based on team projects and an exam that earns you the designation Certified Sustainable Building Advisor.
On Monday, January 19th, explore Edmonton Water City 2040, a scenario planning initiative that maps out a sustainable water strategy for the next 25 years. Attend the event to learn about how the initiative applies innovative thinking and design strategies to create a water system that is resilient, responsible, and responsive. You don't need to be a water expert to attend. Visit terrainforma.ca for more information.
And that goes for all of the events that we've talked about here. So that's all the time we have for this week's show.
Our contributors were Chris Chang-Yen Phillips and Dalal Hanna and Andrea Reed from the Science Faction team.
Trevor Chow Fraser did production.
And Thasmia Nishat did website. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton. We've been your hosts, Carson Fong.
And Thasmia Nishat. Catch you next week.
Science Faction is a show about unbelievable discoveries.
Science Faction.
You're listening to Science Faction.
Dalal, what do you picture when you think about ants?
I see myself as a kid in summer. I'm outside, holding one of those looking glasses, which I had taken from my mom's desk. And I'm dying to find out if what my sister told me is true. Can I really set that little thing on fire? What about you?
Ants also remind me of a summer afternoon. I would sit outside for what seemed like hours, just watching ants build. They'd go in and out of the ground, leaving empty-handed but always coming back, arms totally full. They looked like amazing builders.
They truly are amazing builders, which is why we're going to spend our very first Science Faction show talking to you about the best ant builders known to science. Fire ants.
I'm Andrea.
I'm Dalal. And today, on Science Faction,
we bring you Fire Ant Physics.
Science Faction 101.
We speak in the 1,000 most used words.
The researchers we talk to don't.
These 1,000 words come from
the Opta 5 text editor.
Made by scientist
Theo Sanderson.
We build on these accepted words using prefixes and suffixes.
And we allow the use of numbers and names.
From the names of people and places
to the names of life forms and scientific fields.
We see these few little exceptions as key to bringing you stories factually and informatively. And now for the show.
Fire ants come from wetlands in the Brazilian Amazon, where it rains a lot. And by a lot, I mean up to 3 meters every year.
Can you imagine that kind of rain? That's more rain than we get each year in Montreal, Seattle, and London all together.
You might be able to climb on top of something to escape 3 meters of rain, but these ants are tiny, growing only 6 millimeters tall. So when it rains as much and as often as it does in the Amazon, they need to have an escape plan.
And their plan is so good that they have become rock stars in the world of science.
Today, we want to take you there.
Imagine yourself as a fire ant.
You're underground, just hanging out, doing your ant business.
When all of a sudden, your home is filled with water, and before you know it, it's up to your neck.
There's no obvious way out.
But you're a fire ant, so you're gonna find one.
You grab hold of the ant beside you.
And she grabs hold of the ant beside her.
And she grabs hold of the ant beside her. And so on, until you've reached the ants that have made it above ground.
And here is where the story gets interesting.
Once out, still surrounded by water, with more rain falling, the ants don't just cut and run. They go into this formation. Some side by side, others on top of each other, forming a sort of ball.
Meet one of the world's top fire ant researchers.
My name is David Hu, pronounced Hu like the British sitcom Doctor Who.
He first heard about fire ants,
Solenopsis invicta,
when he was in grad school
at the Georgia Institute of Technology.
He now works with
Craig Tovey. He's a mathematician. In particular, he's a modeler.
And he used to work with
Nathan Malott. He's the first brave soul to really study fire ants the way we study them, which is from the perspective of engineers.
Together, this team has figured out a lot about the physics of these fire ants. To do this, they had to bring the ant world into their lab.
They brought a ton of ants from the great outdoors of Georgia
right into Georgia Tech.
At any given time, there'll be about 600,000 ants in our lab, maybe 5 or 6 colonies. A colony is about 100,000 ants, which is about 2 cups.
A word of warning. Do not try this at home, kids.
Fire ants are very hard to keep in a container.
And they won't delay before setting up shop just about anywhere.
And we have to deal with these emergency calls all the time because ants are always escaping our lab.
That sounds very funny.
One of the first things they tried to figure out is how this
magical ant fall
works. So they put thousands of ants into the water to see how they'd react.
And what happened?
The ants just stayed on the surface. Minutes passed, with some ants under the water and others on top.
You'd think that the ones underneath would run out of air.
But they didn't. And here's how David explains it.
What the ant does, if you look very closely at images of an ant underwater, it actually traps air bubbles all around its body. I mean, imagine if you went underwater and you had all these sort of Christmas ornaments of bubbles stuck to you. Well, the ant has so many that, first of all, those bubbles help buoy it back up to the surface and breathe underwater like a fish. And so that's how the ants survive when they're underwater. They don't drown.
This ant ball can actually stay in the water, not just for minutes, or days, or even weeks.
These rafts, sometimes they float out to the ocean. So imagine it's sort of this lost ship, and they'll survive for months, and they'll actually start eating their eggs and eating their babies and things like that.
More fire ant physics right after this break.
Hi, I'm astronaut Chris Hadfield. You're listening to Science Faction.
It's in part thanks to this remarkable ability that the ants have moved out of Brazil and all the way to Georgia, where Doctor Who studies them today.
And get this, the ants didn't stop at Georgia. They're now on every continent except for Antarctica.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That's amazing. That's really amazing.
That's so cool.
Okay, I'm moving on. Okay. But that's not even the exceptional part. It's what they do getting from one place to the next that is unlike any other animal. If on their way they encounter a roadblock, maybe a fallen tree in the water, or a space that's too big for any one of them to jump across, they band forces and build a passage over whatever gets in their way. You might be picturing the ants building the way that we do, only using sticks and leaves instead of 2x4s.
Yeah. Like the way beavers use pieces of wood to block running water.
But what sets fire ants apart from the rest is that they don't need stuff to build with.
They act as little miniature building materials. So they're both construction workers and they're the bricks.
And to top it off, they're also the repairmen. If a crack forms, the ants immediately move around to fill it in. Fire ant buildings therefore have the ability to self-repair.
Just imagine if our buildings were able to fix themselves, like the ants' buildings can.
We wouldn't have to worry about old, falling down buildings like the Leaning Tower of Pisa ever coming to the ground. Its building blocks would just keep putting themselves back together again.
There's been a lot of interest in building what's called self-healing materials. But it's the idea of having materials like bricks and concrete behave a lot more like living materials.
Okay, let's revisit the facts. First, we have a group of fire ants that can stay on water for months at a time. Second, these ants are able to use themselves as building blocks in getting from water to safety. And third, fire ant buildings have the ability to self-repair.
That's already a lot, but who thinks that there's a lot more that we can learn from these ants?
He hopes that his research will tell us how to build tiny computerized blocks that mirror the ants' activity and repair themselves, or maybe even put themselves together.
Just like the ants do.
So, he and his team run all kinds of small experiments. They press, push, and pull the ants in all directions. They even drop them to understand how they put themselves back together again.
So we're really interested in quantifying how good building materials the ants are. It's basically kind of like a torture chamber for ants. That's what our lab is. It's kind of the unofficial motto.
But whose team is doing more than just putting the ants through hell? They're doing serious fire ant physics.
Imagine you have ants and they built a bridge, and we'll subject that bridge to shaking. So we'll have these very high-precision shakers. We can change the amplitude and vibration of the shaking to similar that the ants would experience in nature.
They act like a really strong wind, or like breaking waves.
To see how the ants react, they make a movie.
We basically use high-speed video. These cameras that record 5,000 frames per second, so almost more than 100 times faster than a regular camera. And we can record where each ant goes in the bridge, and we can record how much the bridge changes in shape due to the stimuli applied.
So then, they make some popcorn, watch the movie, and look very closely at each still.
And what caught their eye had to do with the physical state of the ants.
Or should we say, states?
The ants are what we call a viscoelastic fluid.
A visco what?
Take another listen.
The ants are what we call a viscoelastic fluid.
You know, I don't really get what that means.
That means they have the properties of both solid materials and fluids. So one question we ask are they a fluid or a solid? Seems like a pretty simple question. Well, it turns out that they're both. So ants are both a fluid and a solid. So it depends on what kind of conditions they have.
But so what? What's the big deal about being both?
What do you mean, what's the big deal? This is an important discovery. Fire ants are the only known living thing able to flip between physical states.
This viscoelastic property is very important in dealing with an uncertain environment. One example is surviving floods. So imagine this ant raft is flowing along, and let's say it strikes a stick. It could become stuck, adhered to the stick, but what happens, imagine it would strike the stick, and it would actually, over a long period of time, it would flow around the stick and then keep on going. So this property prevents objects from getting in the raft's way, and it also reduces the force.
Understanding the physics of fire ants is a big step towards humans being able to match the way that ants build and make our own buildings that can self-repair.
This reminds me of how Velcro was inspired by burdock burrs. You know when you walk through the woods and those tiny little pointy things stay stuck all over your clothes and in your hair?
Oh yes, just like Velcro.
Science is always learning from plants and animals. And in this story, the physicists are learning from fire ants in the hopes of making new types of building blocks that self-repair, or perhaps even put themselves together. This is the field of
modular robotics. So imagine you have a bucket of small robot parts, and you dump it on the ground, and these small robots would link their bodies together and stand up and eventually build a larger, more capable robot. Well, this is one of the grand challenges of the robotics community, robots that can really link together in a fashion that's similar to the way our body has linked small entities together and performing one grand function.
This could be very important for space discovery, as NASA is no longer sending many people to space. With this technology, we could send a single set of computerized parts that can put themselves together in different ways and perform many different jobs.
Back here on Earth, this same technology could be used to make one bucket of stuff that does lots of everyday jobs, like cleaning the car or cutting the grass. But we're not quite there yet. So in the meantime, the next best thing might just be to keep learning from those fire ants.
I think David said it best, so we'll give him the last words of the day.
I mean, a lot of things that ants can do are only what roboticists could dream of. So imagine 100,000 individual entities, and they all combine together and they form one task. There's an inherent robustness in having lots of different parts. You can take any one of these ants out, and the structure will still be there, and it'll still perform its functions. And there's also this idea of, I mean, this is getting into philosophical things, but the ants are an example of an emergent system. So when the ants build a bridge, or they build a raft, or they build a tower, the way they build is very different from the way we build things. So there's no sort of construction worker, there's no boss, no leader. The building emerges from the ants following these simple rules and just interacting. I mean, you can imagine it's similar to the way your brain works. Your brain is composed of individual cells that really just all they do is fire, and they fire according to whether they're fired upon. You have one or two cells, you don't really get very much. Same with one or two ants, but when you put 100,000 together, you start to get things that can think, and then you got Shakespeare and things like that. And so understanding the physics behind how these emergent things come about from these simple interactions, that's sort of also one of the big interests in why we're studying ants too.
That's a wrap.
Thanks for checking out Science Faction's first show, Fire Ant Physics.
We're done for now, but we do want to hear from you.
Get in touch with us on Twitter at SciFact Radio.
And search for us on Facebook.
Science Faction is Dalal Hanna and Andrea Reed, with sounds and music made by Nick Schofield, and is supported by Jeune Volontaire. Visit us online at sciencefaction.ca.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, thanks again.